My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N, and I'm with Air Vice Marshal George R. Housam, H-O-W-S-A-M. Air Vice Marshal Housam has the Companion of the Bath, as well as the Military Cross, and the Canadian Forces Decoration.
The PFA. No. Not the CD.
You have the ED?
No. None of us asked for it, and none of us accepted.
I see. Okay. The date today is 15 August 1979, and we're at Air Vice Marshal's home in Gordon Head. Air Vice Marshal Housam wishes a 10-year hold on this tape, so therefore it's not to be used until for 10 years after this date.
That's on this particular tape.
This particular tape and this particular item, which is his first World War flying career. Sir, last time we got you about as far as the pilot's pool in France, and I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just a brief redescription of where you were sent, which squadron you joined.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we had completed our training in the Royal Flying Corps in Canada and in England. This is in the spring of 1917 in Canada, until about the end of September, late in September, 17.
Uh-huh.
We were sent to France, to the pilot's pool at Saint-Omer. And we were there, a few days. The Battle of Passchendaele had started by the time we got to the pool. So it was probably early October by that time before I got into was selected for a squadron. And I was posted to number 70 squadron, Camels, near Poppering, which is just behind Ypres, Ypres, whatever they want to
Wipers?
Call it. Wipers. Everything.
What did you guys call it?
Ypres, usually. But of course, I know that our Canadian bad. Our French is worse than decent bakers is now. So
you mean still a temporary acting or no, an acting second lieutenant or temporary second lieutenant?
Temporary acting second lieutenant. Anything lower than that in rank, I'd like to know about it. As a commissioned rank.
Yes.
As our first.
Oh, that's one.
The great idea of that was simply if you didn't cut the mustard as an officer, there was no court-martial, there was no great fuss, all they had to stroke the pen and you were back somewhere else and that's all it was about. So it saved a lot of trouble.
And get around the paperwork, I guess.
That's right.
The red tape.
And there's no problem about it. You had all the authority, all you had to do was cut the mustard. Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Now you joined a 70 squadron RFC. Which is a camel squadron, so you'd be flying the Sopwith Camel.
That's right.
And it would have the, two guns on the front now?
Two Vickers.
Yes,
I think all the camels came out with, even the earlier ones. I think that was a great improvement over its earlier or younger sister, the Pup.
Mm-hmm.
The Sopwith Pup, it only had one gun firing forward, and some of the time it had an upper gun that you had to pull down over the top wing, and it took a lot of time. The ball had thrown that with an upper wing gun. I think most of the time it was on a Newport, but it had the same idea, the same gun, only mounted on different aircraft.
Well,
this gun, but we had two Vickers, and it was fired up to 800 rounds a minute, the two guns, and they were beautifully aligned, sighted. If you took the care to see that they were that way, you yourself as pilot, so that is up to your job.
Mm-hmm. Now, would your plane be called a bus in that sense, or
I doubt that came down all the way through for years and years, but I doubt that it started that early. I don't recall. I think that is something that happened in the Canadian setup, but it is a bus.
A bus. Now, we talked about markings last time, so if anyone's interested in markings, they can get it off the last tape.
Well, they are.
But, I guess what I'm getting at is that, now, were you assigned a plane as soon as you got there, or were you to wait until one came available for you?
Well, that would depend entirely on the strength of the squadron. Actually, I was lucky in that regard. I did get my plane assigned pretty early. I don't remember that I had it the first day, but I had it very quickly, And it is most useful because then you can arrange your controls to suit you and the length of your leg and the length of your cushions and arrange your seating.
He would have a fitter and a mechanic.
Oh, each aircraft had its own little crew, and if you became part of that crew, the first thing you had to do, get accustomed to working with your troops and your men.
Yeah.
I was very lucky in that regard for the most part all the way through. The English fitters, the English mechanics were excellent, A1 plus. You couldn't believe how good they were and how interested they were in you. And if you can, again, I'll use that phrase, if you cut the mustard to the satisfaction of your troops, and that is your great job, to measure up to what they expected in leadership, and you set the pattern.
I guess they wouldn't want you piling up their plane. I guess that's the way they'd be.
If you came back with bullet holes through your plane, they were the ones that packed, and every time you had a victory, they immediately put a marking on the elevators and the rudder of your plane. So the 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and were they proud? Their chest was out a mile.
Is that right?
The gunners and the fitters, of course, they're part of your crew.
Of course. And what kind of markings would you be, stripes?
They're just a little marking that they could read themselves. You couldn't see it in the air. We wouldn't allow that.
Now, you join the squadron. You go into, I believe it's a day flight to start with?
Yes, I went into A flight. As I mentioned, the Battle of Passchendaele then was well on, and the losses had been very extreme, especially among the new pilots. The new ones, inexperienced, seemed to buy wounds very quickly, and probably more than wounds.
The Sopwith itself, maybe?
No, by that time, most of them could fly their aircraft. But it's a bad time to join in a squadron when it's right in the middle of an intensive battle. And the Battle of the Passchendaele was one of the most intensive battles, plus the one of the March battle through them both. Intensive period.
Well, the March 18, of course, was
the great Flying Corps battle,
yeah,
where it really was tested.
Now, you remained with A Flight. As you said, you would be flying the line to start with. Is that correct?
Well, there were all sorts of different patrols, but there were two main types. One was called the line patrol. That meant that you were flying largely in the front of the army front that you're on.
Mm-hmm.
We were in number 2 Army, General Plumer, and you patrolled largely back, up and down, right above the Plumer's battle front line, because the other people look after their own battle front. And we, of course, shook hands or respected on either side of us with the air part of the line.
Mm-hmm.
But the line patrol was not required to go far over into enemy territory. Your main job was to stay right over the battle line, largely right over the battle line, and protect the Army Cooperation aircraft, the aircraft that are working with the guns, all the supporting
artillery observers, I guess, is that right?
Well, yes, we observed for the certain type of aircraft, but that is not a. We ourselves had to take care of our own aircraft too, our own other squadrons, and they always came to see us the night before, telephoned us, said, "Goodness, we're going to be over rulers, or we're going to be men on the rulers men road, spotting for the guns tomorrow morning. Keep an eye on us, for goodness sake. These are our friends in the other squadron."
Yeah. And then the second, I guess, the tactical role would be penetration, is that correct?
Well, the second role they call the offensive patrol.
That
meant that you went well into German territory.
And that would be
with selected targets.
And that would be the small bombs.
Well, we carried up to either 2 50-pound bombs or 4 25, 30 pounders, whatever they were.
Would it be high explosives, or would there be a mixture?
We didn't pack them, they came to us already made, and all we had to do was lay our eggs in the right position and blow up the guns.
How high would you usually bomb from altitude lines?
Well, it depends on the target and how well it's defended, but if we could lay them down from about 200 feet.
200 feet?
200 feet. Well, you see, we had, our bomb sights were nil in those days, and all we could do was get at the right angle and dive, the right angle of dive, which greatly increased our speed.
Oh, yeah.
And then if we went below that, we would have very little chance of pulling out of the dive. Now, the great thing to do is to line them with in your own gun sights at an angle of about something in the vicinity of 45-degree dive. That's a fair one. And to lay the eggs properly.
And you sure your airspeed would be great at this point.
Well, with full power on, you didn't care. You were right off the you wound your airspeed indicator maybe around an extra time, but you couldn't tell. Once you're off, your controls are getting tighter and tighter, and you know you're going faster and faster. So you can't pull out in a second. You pull the wings off your aircraft.
Well, there was a fear you could actually pull the wings off.
Well, we never did, because if you did, you wouldn't be around to tell us.
Okay, fair enough. Was there any great concern about pulling your wings off?
No, we tested them pretty well. We knew about what to do and about where to give it full throttle, because you wouldn't start, say, from 10,000 feet or 12,000 feet or 15,000 feet or whatever with a full load on and dive all the way towards the ground, because that'd just be suicide. You just
so
wouldn't
you
do
would
it.
Fly your aircraft to limits, eh?
Well, you would spoil your engine. Your engine would disintegrate properly. See, after all, with a rotary engine, as your speed increased, the centrifugal force becomes greater and greater. Yeah. And sooner or later, you're going to blow a cylinder head.
Yes.
Right off. And then your engine will certainly not be running very well.
Great. You remained with A Squadron for the Battle of Passchendaele, am I correct there? Or were you moved during that time?
No. just toward the end of the battle, I was able to get myself moved from A flight to another flight, C
now,
flight.
I gather, if I'm not mistaken, that the man in charge of A flight, was less than desirable, is that correct?
Well, as a man, he probably was all right, but he was a poor type of leader in my book.
Do you recall his name at all? Or?
Yes, I do, but I don't think I don't know whether he's still alive. He might be still alive, and he isn't, so... His great fault in leadership was he didn't train his pilots too well before, and he took them over the line or into the line, and he didn't train them very well there, because once he got over the battle line or into the battle, he simply never looked around to see where his troops were. He didn't know where his aircraft were. He would just do what we call, he could put his head down in the office and glued his eyes straight ahead and forgot all about the troops. Well, a leader must know what all his troops are doing and see that where they are and protect them and
guide them and everything.
Well, yes, and furthermore, he just mustn't run away by himself. And furthermore, the average commanding officer of a flight, CO, he gets about the best aircraft. And it'll probably be a little faster than... And the leader can never fly at full throttle. He must fly at a lesser throttle than the troops behind him, because they have to maneuver and follow him. So that is his first rule. He forgot. He just rammed the throttle full forward. He put his head down the office, and away he went. Well, he lost so many young pilots, and that's why his replacements were unbelievably high. I was glad to get out.
Weren't you saying, if I'm not mistaken, last time that your first flight with him, you ended up being lost there for him?
Not the first one, but the first difficult one. It was during the Battle of Passchendaele, and it was the weather was bad, and it was just touch and go whether we should fly at all or not. So I agreed to go, and he acted as I just told you. He put his head down. And we were flying at a fair height, around 8 or 10,000 feet, and trying to get out of target behind our lines. And in no time, the weather was so bad that we ran into heavy icing, which I'd never been in before. There was no icing in Canada, and in the summer you were there, and there's none in England in August, September, or first part of September. And this is my first introduction of icing. Now, icing on the wing is very bad, and we were so busy trying to keep your aircraft from as soon as an aircraft starts to ice up, it doesn't ice up equally all over, and you've got a heavy wing on your right or a heavy wing on your left, and the aircraft isn't flying true, and your controls are certainly, you've got to keep moving them all the time, they might freeze solid on you freeze up to an extent. And furthermore, the camber on your wings, the more ice gets on it, you don't know what sort of curve you've got on the wings and what kind of lift you're going to get from the aircraft. So I ran. Yes, well, he didn't look after his troops at all, as I say, and I got lost, and all I could do is try to fly west. That was the idea. Once you, anything happens to you, you don't know where you are, you fly west, and then keep on time by time, and then I know I flew west, and I couldn't find a spot that I knew, and I kept on flying west until I was about running out of country and going to be over ocean, so I landed in a field, and... that was
about how far were you from?
Well, I was quite a long way, and I remember I had a great time trying to speak in my Diefenbaker French to the natives. I had only been there a short time, and my schoolboy French was definitely not very good. But I ended up by convincing that the British Army would pay, and I got some essence into my aircraft and finally flew it home. Then I got moved to another flight. Fortunately, almost after that.
What about as the pilot himself? Your altitude. You weren't a ceiling squadron, is that correct?
Pardon?
You wouldn't be what was known as a ceiling squadron.
Well,
you wouldn't be flying at 16 to 18.
Oh, yes, we did get up there.
Oh, you did. Did get up there.
Yes, about 17,000 was actually the ceiling of the Camel. With that type of engine.
With your engine?
We had an English engine. An English built Clergy. The Clergy was a French built engine. But when they'd run out of the French ones that were manufactured by the French the Clergy, they manufactured them in England. Now, the English Clergy, I think the old Clergy, they were all what they called a single ignition, only one spark plugged to one cylinder. But the French, by this time, had come up with the idea of putting two spark plugs into each cylinder of the engine, and that increased the revolutions and the power, and they could get a little higher. So we managed to, sooner or later, we managed to get the new twin double ignition Clergy. And then we progressed from that, I suppose the progress to the Lerone. Now, the Lerone engine didn't have as much power up to 12,000 feet, but over above 12,000 feet, the Lerone would go on another 2,000 or 3,000 feet above 17,000. But it did not have the power down below. Well, most of us preferred to have the power up to 12,000 or 14,000 feet. And then we got an English version of what they call the long stroke Clergy, a longer stroke piston, and that put our horsepower up above the French Clergy. So all of these things were gradual steps into better performance.
Well, what about oxygen and clothing and things like that?
At that time, we had no trouble with clothing. You wear what you like.
The standard wear would be what, the leathers, or would it be the...
We had both. Both the what they called the Sidcot suit, you wore in the colder winter weather, and then an ordinary heavy leather flying coat, and we all had sheepskin-lined boots, and they came right up to your thigh, right up.
Sheepskin boots right up to the thigh, and then gauntlets as well, I guess.
Long leather gowns up to cover your...
Sort of a silk glove inside as well.
Well, that's what I wore, yes, silk gloves. And also, I wore a silk inside my helmet, the lining, because it's a very good thing. And the silk could cover your nose, and it kept your eyes and mouth open. You had a little space for your eyes and mouth, but the silk could actually cover your nose if you want to let it.
Now, the helmet itself would be leather
too.
Skull cap, I guess.
It was a good helmet. You usually bought your own. There was an issue, but you could get a better one if you wanted to buy your own. And the two things that I bought, my helmet and my goggles. Now, Triplex made a goggle that was pretty well, it's pretty well bulletproof. It would stand up to most bullets, and all it would do is shatter the glass. Well, your eyes are tremendously important. And my friends told me long before I went I was on my way to France, get your own helmet, get your own goggles, and the rest of the issue is excellent. So we bought our own.
And no oxygen?
Oxygen, yes, came not at that time out, not on the Camel. We had the oxygen only came in the Snipe, and that was a year later. Mm-hmm. So when I went out the second time after I was wounded, and that was on the sniper, but the action was very raw, very crude. It's difficult to get the right amount of it. It's brand new. I knew how to use it, and all the machinery, all the. They didn't know anything about it. This is brand, completely new. And the great trouble, of course, was the cloud of your goggles. And what are you going to do when you couldn't see?
Take off the oxygen.
And push up your goggles and fight. Fight it out. If you're in the middle of a fight, you can't. Away go the goggles and away go everything else and get on to fighting.
Now, I'm thinking before you had this, when you were in 70 Squadron, before you had the oxygen, was there any problem with flying at, say, 16, 18, or 17,000 feet?
On the Camel, we didn't stay there long. See, you get up there, but unless there's something to do up there, what are you waiting there for? You went with the action. And that usually was taking place down around 10 or 12,000 feet. But it's a great thing to have the weather gauge at 14 or 15 or 16,000 feet above, and then you dive down, you came in with lots of speed, plenty of speed and power, and you arrive in the battle ready to do fight.
Okay, well, what I was getting at, though, is that you weren't having, like, terrible headaches and things like that.
That didn't get... Later on, yes, when I went to the snipe, but that's another story, and you're way up a year ahead to see...
Okay, well, we'll leave that until then.
The snipe, that is after I'd been wounded in the battle of... the march push, just the ambulance. Yeah.
Now, your formation, were you using a gaggle of formation, or were you into three?
We started off at that time in the whole of France. They were flying very good formation, but largely with the V formation. And as I mentioned, Quigley was the Sea Flight Commander. But no, he was the second in command, but he very shortly became the commander. The commander of Sea Flight, and I went, there was a man called Kemsley, an Englishman who'd been in Canada for a number of years, so he knew our Canadian ways and he was an excellent flight commander. But he was very getting on, he's a bit much older than any of us, and this is his second tour out in France, and he was just finishing up his second tour, and he's a very tired man, very tired. But Quigley, of course, Quigley was on his first tour, and he was the second in command, and he himself was tremendous. And if you care to read that letter that I was telling you about, it largely had to do with the period in France with Quigley, if you'd like to get that on
I'd
tape.
I'd love to get that on tape, sir.
Well, then, with whatever restrictions you want to put on it. Well, this letter, report, it is a... It's pretty well condensed, at least I think it is, I hope it is, covering the period after I transferred from A flight to C flight. And Quigley,
what, around November, am I correct? November,
December, I think.
December.
I was there.
Thereabouts.
Now, it's in a letter form. This is a letter that I wrote at a request from a man in England. Who was writing the story of the 70 Squadron, but particularly with regard to Frank Granger Quigley. He was the man that I'm talking about, Frank Quigley. And that he was my flight commander he was the one who really taught me about anything I know in flying. He was the leader of my...
Your mentor, I guess.
Well, he was just Mr. Everything. To me, he was a graduate of Queen's University. Now, this is a matter that I wrote to... Dear Mr. Wetton, Whetton, further to my earlier letter, number 70 Squadron RFC, and in particular to Frank Quigley, when I joined number 70 Squadron at Poppering, late in October 17, so Quigley was deputy leader and second in command of Sea Flight. Captain Kemsley was the commander of Sea Flight. Major Gray Edwards was the new commanding officer of 70 Squadron, having recently succeeded Major Nethersole. A and B flights had suffered severe losses in the Passchendaele battle. I was first posted to A flight. The A flight commander displayed little ability, either in technique of fighting in the air or of flight leadership. The morale of all ranks in A flight was low. Fortunately, Kemsley and Quigley took a keen interest in all squadron members. For example, during our squadron fitness exercises, including our
squadron and a flight cross-country runs, bad weather scrub games on the tarmac and the aerodrome. Quigley especially took a full part in the games and always entered into friendly discussions covering new fighter tactics now possible on the highly maneuverable Camel. Quigley stressed the great importance of keeping fit and in the daily practice of fighting fighter tactics. You practice your tactics before you put them into effect over the line. His friendly example and understanding were most helpful to all neophyte pilots on the tarmac, in the air, and in the mess. The same applied to Kemsley, but as I mentioned, he was much older, very tired, and almost reached the end of his second tour of duty in the RFC in France and in Belgium. As mentioned, Quigley was outstanding in fighter tactics. He was one of the first to introduce the new unit of three, as opposed to the old V-type formation, which was most unwieldy, except when diving and zooming. The German D-5 Albatross and Fokker D-7 used the V formation, in which the rear aircraft, including numbers 4, 5, 6, and 7, etc., if more aircraft were involved, those rear aircraft were poorly protected. In the unit of three formation, all aircraft were well protected, mutually within each unit. The whole formation was highly maneuverable, which enabled a good concentration of firepower. Quigley also introduced the defensive power flick roll. The aim, I remember the word is defensive. This is the way to throw your enemy off. If he's got the weather gauge and shooting and he's getting his bullets too close, get out, get somewhere else.
Purely defensive, not offensive.
You can return to the offensive at any time you like.
Because of this.
If you're still alive, you better be alive. The aim was to throw the heavy German fighters into overshooting their target. They would be as much, when they had engines, it would go much higher, stationary engines.
Mm-hmm.
It had the greater power. They invariably could get the weather gauge on the Camel, that is, that greater height. But once you could throw them off their first aim, they'd lose that height, or they'd lose that speed. And if you could throw them off, you could immediately have the weather gauge on them, or very shortly, or just a comparable gauge. You didn't need a weather gauge with a Camel. Once you could throw them off their first, avoid that first strike firepower. So that is the aim of it. The Camel then quickly moved in tightly after the flick roll, the power
pause,
of the flick
sir,
roll.
Sir, maybe we could pause until the clock's finished. Okay, the clock stopped. sorry, sir.
Well, as I said, the aim of the defensive power flick roll was to throw the heavy German fighters into overshooting their target. They had the weather gauge. Now, if you make them overshoot you, and you could come in immediately behind them in the power flick roll, which enabled you to do. It was a skill maneuver only that could be performed on an aircraft like the Camel.
Because of its response.
Well, because of the two main factors, the response of these other aircraft are pretty good. Your other aircraft, our own anyway, was excellent. But there were two factors. One, the torque, the normal propeller torque, was considerable, and you had to allow for that with your controls and fight that torque all the time or take care of it. Now with a rotary engine, the whole engine revolved and the propeller was fixed to the rotating engine. The propeller, your crankshaft, stood still. But the main thing, the two factors, one is the torque of the propeller itself in revolving, and the centrifugal force of this whole engine revolving had a tremendous power, even much greater than the torque. Both of these were in the same direction, and that is why the aircraft wanted to turn to the right all the time. So you had to learn to hold that turn off and to do it. So you used very, very little rudder on your aircraft to turn to the right. But you used a considerable, extraordinary amount to make it turn to the left. Now, younger people couldn't get out of that for a while, and that's why one chief reason why so many young pilots were seriously injured and killed, and the Camel was supposed to be... Well, once you understood that and it could handle it, it had a million tricks. And very useful tricks. Mm-hmm. And if you could exploit them, well, you could turn on what we said, on a dime and give you back a dollar in change.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very useful. So we exploited the capability of your aircraft. This is great. This is a good thing to do.
So, describing the flick rule itself, I'm wondering if you could do it, because I know I can't, but I think I understand, because of the centrifugal force, because of the torque,
using
that as well.
The flick roll was made for the Camel, because with that kind of engine, because you had the torque and the centrifugal action of the revolving engine, both fantastic power, both in the same direction.
Well, so if you were in the plane, how would you do the flick roll?
Well, very, very quickly. You had to...
No.
I'll tell you, so many people are confused now because they think of a slow roll, where you fly your aircraft. The Camel could do it too, but you'd fly the Camel all the way around beautifully. They do the slow roll. We did it later on in the Snipe and again in the Siskins and then right down all the fighters in World War II could fly them, and they do it today. All your three or four aircraft do a roll together. That is what they call a slow roll. But you fly it all the way around. But the flick roll was simply a fantastic thrust, immediate thrust, that put the aircraft into almost...
Now, that'd be the thrust with the throttle. Is that the idea?
No. Very little throttle in it. You'd actually use about... there would be no extra throttle used at the beginning of the roll. The flick was on your controls. You allowed all the power that was going into into your flying anyway would continue it, but not anymore. It didn't greatly increase the power, but you allowed the centrifugal force and the torque and whatever rudder you needed, plus the elevators, and...
Around you went.
With full power, which means that the aircraft really did 360 degrees. And you had to know how long to do it to come out right side up. When you, the first time you did, you probably spun, went into a spin at the top or somewhere. And you did a, you,
well, what about the spin in the Camel? There was a claim that it was very difficult to get out of a spin in the Camel.
No, not if you know how. It was difficult to get out of many of the aircraft. You didn't know how to fly them. You didn't know how to... Each one had its own particular requirement to get out.
Now, I heard, now you can correct this, and I hope you will, but I heard that if you got into a spin with altitude, you just let go of the stick and it would come back by itself.
Well, in the very beginning, that is a crude way of doing it. They were so frightened, and they didn't know what to do, and they couldn't believe. See, in getting out of a spin on a normal aircraft, the first thing to do is put your stick right forward. Now, normally, that puts an aircraft into a dive. But you're spinning, so it doesn't go into dive. It slows it down. Then you put usually opposite aileron a little and neutralize your rudder, or you could use your rudder a little bit to slow it down. You had to find out and feel for yourself just what you should do on each type of aircraft. I would say that you put your stick right forward. I did on most of my... now, this applies to fighters.
Yes.
I used the same thing on a big passenger plane and myself in a thunderstorm, and it worked. So, many years later.
Many years later. Yeah. The principle's still the same. Now, back to the flick roll, the idea is to use that centrifugal force, do a 360-degree turn so that the plane behind
you... Not a turn. See, I'm sorry.
Roll, I'm sorry.
You're not turning. Your aircraft is going straight on to target.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Remember the aim.
I'm just trying to get it nailed down.
Remember your aim.
This is what I'm getting at.
The aim was to get your enemy to overshoot you.
And therefore...
And if they were in the stationary aircraft, engine aircraft, going like fury, and they didn't know it was coming. And they were just lining up on you, and then you aren't there. You do the flick roll, and in the meantime, with their stationary engine, they couldn't turn that quickly. They were much less maneuverable, and they didn't have this fantastic aid of
the
torque and the centrifugal force.
And I guess, and they wouldn't be, as you said, they wouldn't.
Well, they couldn't do it. They didn't expect it. It took them by surprise.
And therefore, they would go past you.
Well, then the aim was again to go past you. But in any case, you got out of their way. You completed your flick roll. You had them not shooting at you, but you frequently could be in a position to shoot at them.
And you would come out shooting at them?
You would come out, you practiced it until you could flick the aircraft and come out shooting.
Now, would you do the... Now, this would be an individual.
No.
You couldn't. You wouldn't do it as a...
Well, of course, we flew formation, but we didn't... In a fight, you never flew wingtip to wingtip. It would be crazy.
Okay.
At that time. You had a reasonable area to maneuver.
Okay.
And you were... The normal one, where we flew in the three, the number one was the leader, and he was there. Number two was on the left, and he usually flew just a little higher than his leader. The other one on the right flew just a little lower.
I see.
So you see, just a little. You didn't need to be very far off. And in that way, you could do your flick rolls without colliding. And there's no profit in colliding.
No.
So I think we wasted too much time on this flick.
Well, I don't think we wasted it. I think it's a it's tactical.
But it's useless without the centrifugal action, the great centrifugal force.
But at its time, it was it your best defensive maneuver?
Well,
or one of the best?
It would be the one, so long as you got surprise, we didn't care how we got it.
Okay.
But it did... for a long time, and since none of the others could perform it, unless they had that type of engine, and there were very few of them. The Germans didn't have it at all. They had no rotary engine at all at that time, as far as I remember. We were very glad to get the radial engine. It came in and stood still, but we developed new... It had so many other advantages that you could forget about the flick roll. It only happened to be...
applicable to this plane.
I don't know of any other plane that it could be done. For example, when I went down to the Siskin to the site, the bigger sister with a 300 horsepower British rotary engine, it had fantastic power, and we could fly. That's where we got the auction. We go up to 24,000 feet, and it had all the power we needed. We didn't need the flick roll anymore, and furthermore, no one else had the altitude on us to attack us in that way. So you'd never use that tactic unless you had a reason to use it.
Okay.
It could only be a defensive flick roll, a defensive tactic.
Great. Okay.
But don't confuse it with a slow roll.
No.
A slow roll, you had to fly your aircraft all the way around. This, you didn't fly it exactly. You just flick it, and it flicked for you. And it's a matter of timing and skill.
And this was developed by...
Quigley. And I don't know anyone else that ever performed it quite as well as he did.
Great.
But he made us do the best we could.
Okay.
Well, so much for that. Now, where do you want me to go on?
Where you left off, just after the flick roll there, I believe, sir. Towards the end of the page.
He was one of the first...
No, he's down towards the end here.
Oh. Quigley also... you're right. In any case, Seaflight had good successes with Quigley's tactics, and fewer casualties at that time than those using the older V formation. That is our payoff. He had far fewer casualties. More of us lived to tell the story, or be on the story and do the work. And especially those using the old V formation. The Battle of Passchendaele had ended, and the intense fighting in the air had eased by mid-November. Gray had...
Take a pause here. We're back on tape, sir.
Well, you go ahead. I was interrupted. All right, well, I'll start at the beginning of that paragraph. The Battle of Passchendaele had ended, and the intense fighting in the air had eased by mid-November. Gray Edwards decided to adjust the personnel within all flights. Sea Flight, much to my joy, asked for me in exchange. Kemsley was about to return to England. I became Quigley's first choice. Also, in addition, it had been my privilege to fly several replacement offensive patrols led by Quigley prior to this personnel flight adjustment. Sea Flight became my home from that time on until I was wounded during the March retreat of the Fifth Army in 1918. Now, this is a brief resume. January and February 1918. All through January and February, we were engaged chiefly in front of the Second Army from Hulthurst Forest to Menin, Rulers Ridge, and south to the extent of the salient, up to a depth of 10 to 12 miles. That would be about the depth we went in. Sometimes a little farther, but mostly around 10 or 12 miles in behind the German lines. It's a pretty good way of distance to come home through the battle. And then they gave you were exposed a long time over enemy territory. Pretty difficult. It was in this area that our chief air battles took place, well over the German lines. We bombed selected targets, and our aim was to defend that airspace from all enemy aircraft, including his Army Cooperation two-seaters, who were spotting for the German guns. Our line patrols worked immediately above the front lines and also provided support and protection to our Army two-seater aircraft in spotting for our artillery. We called our line patrol the cushy job. An English term, I guess, a cushy job. Now, I'm referring to his letter now. In your letter of 13th September, you attached an excerpt from Alf Coe's logbook. Alf Coe is one of our pilots in B flight. And this is the IE. Frank Doherty didn't come back. Quigley, Housam, and Todd each got a Hun. That raid took place in the morning, when Doherty got lost and brought down. Quigley and I felt that Doherty might have landed in the mist and fog. It is possible we might find him by going out to search. And if so, we would try to land and pick him up. One would land, the other would fly cover. We would pick him up, we'd have to sort of strap him to over the... No place to sit inside, there's only one seater. We'd have to strap him over the camber of the plane and take off, and the other one would fly cover. In any case, we went out.